Welcome, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today on the program, we're going to talk about synthetic biology, the redesign of living organisms so that they create products we currently get from nature or create artificially using chemistry. Labs in the Bay Area, UC Berkeley and Stanford are hotbeds for this research, and there's also an active private sector here. Amyris, a lab in Emeryville, is engineering the DNA in yeast cells to create replacements for petroleum-based fuels. And this past year, they also released a yeast-based drug that can be used against malaria. Jack Newman is co-founder and chief science officer at Amyris, and he recently told the Washington Post, "You can now build a cell the same way you might build an app for the iPhone." We're going to find out just what that means from Jack, who joins us on the line from Emeryville. Jack, welcome to Your Call.
Thank you. Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Now, Amyris is just one of hundreds of companies and labs doing work on synthetic biology, and the commercial applications of this technology are just starting to enter the market. In 2014, a synthesized form of vanillin, that's the flavoring that's extracted from the vanilla bean, is scheduled to become commercially available, so it may end up in your ice cream, many other food products, and there's hundreds of other diverse products that are in the pipeline. And the rapid emergence of these products concerns a lot of environmentalists who consider synthetic biology extreme genetic engineering. And they say that the potential risk of this technology to the environment and the human health require a cautious approach. One of the groups that has expressed some really strong reservations about this technology is Friends of the Earth, which has specifically called for a boycott of biosynthetic vanilla. And we are joined today by Dana Pearls. She's a food and technology campaigner with Friends of the Earth. Thanks so much for being with us, Dana.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you here. And just as the science of synthetic biology is emerging, so is the public understanding of it. I know myself, I learned a lot just in the last couple of days understanding this technology and where it's moving and how quickly. And also, we're having a regulatory framework that is trying to keep up with this technology. And that is where Eleanor Powles comes in. She is a public policy scholar with the Science and Technology Innovation Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington. And she looks at the challenges that biotechnology pose for policymakers and how scientific developments are regulated. She joins us from Washington. Eleanor, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Matt. I'm delighted to be part of this show. Hi, Jack. Hi, Dana.
Hello.
Great. So I'm hoping what we can have here is a conversation where first folks can really start to understand what this technology is, what makes it different from what's gone before, how it's being put to use, and then what potential implications might be and what that means for how we might want to regulate it, limit certain uses of it, support other uses of it. So I want to start with you, Jack, just because you're a scientist and you've worked in this for a long time. So explain, what would you say, what defines synthetic biology versus some of the other ways that we might produce a product?
Well, let me start by just saying a little bit about the history of recombinant or DNA technology, which I became very interested in high school, and I'm 47 years old, so this is a while ago, in the 80s, when, you know, we started to become able to reprogram genetic systems to make things. And some of the early successes there were the production of insulin, which we used to extract from either cadavers or farm animals. You know, the gene, the human gene for insulin could be expressed in a yeast or something that you can do in fermentation, and it produces a much cleaner and, of course, a much more reliable product. And I read that in high school, and I was like, this is amazing. Now, you know, that at that time, of course, it raised the eyebrows of quite a few folks, including those in the science community. And, you know, there was an effort to sort of understand what the implications of this technology were, which, you know, consummated in a well-known conference in California called the Asilomar Conference. And what was concluded there is that the potential here is just enormous. And, of course, this was very exciting, you know, for somebody who was studying biology in high school and wanted to major in that in college. And I'd say, you know, since the 80s, what's really changed and what has enabled, you know, synthetic biology is the tools that are available for doing that very same sort of recombinant DNA technology. So it's kind of like we've had computers since, let's say, you know, the 20s, but it wasn't until we really got good at programming that everybody had one in their pocket.
So just because I know, I mean, some people talk about this being the application of engineering to biology. And for those of us who aren't experts on either of them, that doesn't necessarily explain it. So maybe you could just briefly talk about how, first, so what's one of these processes? I mean, what's been the breakthrough that you're talking about in terms of what computing can do? How has that changed what you're able to do when it comes to this work in biology?
Right. Well, and I would trace this back, and I would recommend a book called Guns, Germs, and Steel, which is a great sort of history of technology, if you will. And, you know, the human species, of course, has been perfecting the ability to engineer biology for its own use for a very long time. I mean, that's what gave us modern wheat and, you know, corn and things like that. I mean, probably the only, you know, food source that is untouched by human hand to date is maybe the acorn, because it took so long to breed an oak tree that, you know, nobody ever really engineered one. The breakthrough here is that in a much more rapid and controlled way, we can now do what conventional breeding took maybe thousands of years to do in sort of your lifetime.
And so what does that mean? What happens at the Amaris Lab? What are you doing on a day-to-day basis like that? Give us an example and tell us just how one of these organisms works, what goes in, what comes out.
Well, I'll use one of the products that was launched this year called artemisinin, which is a cure for malaria that had been traditionally extracted from plants. It's an old cure for malaria. It's 95% effective against malaria. In 3 days, you can be cured of malaria. But the supply is quite limited because it's in a very low percentage and in very rare amounts in a plant. So what we would do at Amaris, and this is work I started in my postdoc at UC Berkeley with Jay Kiesling, was go to the plant that actually made this drug. And so somewhere in the DNA blueprint of this plant, there are instructions for how to make artemisinin, this anti-malarial drug. You take those instructions in the form of DNA and introduce them into essentially a beer brewing yeast. And now what is produced in very small quantities can be produced industrially, very cleanly, and in very large quantities, stably and reliably in industrial fermentations. Does that make sense?
And so what do you feed the yeast?
Yeah, so yeast can eat a lot of different things. We've been feeding yeast corn traditionally. If you want to make whiskey or rum, you use sugar cane. So yeast will eat, you know, almost any carbon source that is fermentable. At Amaris, we focus on sugar cane as a feedstock because it is probably the lowest cost and the most environmentally sustainable crop.
Okay, so that's Jack Newman. He's with Chief Science Officer at Amaris, one of the cutting-edge companies working on biosynthetic technologies based here in Emeryville in the Bay Area. I want to bring Dana Pearls in, who's the food and technology campaigner with Friends of the Earth. So, Dana, if we're hearing Jack's story here, he's saying basically, you know, human beings for a long time have been involved in some kind of engineering of biology, and that this is simply the latest step of this, and that, you know, hey, here we go. You know, his company got a grant from the Gates Foundation to do this work, to make this anti-malarial that's now available in a way and to an extent that it wouldn't have been possible without this technology. Why should we be concerned if there's this continuity of this technology and here's the kind of good thing that comes out of it?
Thanks. I think it's a really great question and an important one to bring up. I think, first of all, while we might be manipulating nature in many ways over the years, this is a very new technology, and 20 years of experimentation versus thousands of years of nature perfecting our different ingredients in botanical plants across and animals is not the same thing. The fact that we are rewriting the codes of life and creating entire machines to replicate life is entirely new. I think that it's incredibly dangerous to think that we can treat life as a machine, and that these are not appropriate solutions to very real life problems. I think that the corporate control takes the plants out of the hands of people, and there are a lot of real justice implications. When you remove the livelihoods of thousands of farmers across the world who grow this very special plant used for malaria for malaria pills. And I would just want to caution some of the things that were just said. I think that one of the things that is important to know is that there is not, in fact, a limited supply. There is the group, the Assured Artemedicine Supply Initiative, has said that the farmers currently provide the world with an effective, stable supply of the drug, and in fact, production has been in surplus. So I think one of the big cautions to synthetic biology, not just for the use of anti-malaria pills, but also for food, additives, flavors, biofuels, is that this is not needed. This is a problem masquerading as a solution. We have enough supply of artemedicin. It creates a larger problem than it solves. And I think that while it's important to look at what we can do in a lab, and that there is quite a huge potential for this new technology, we really need to dig more deeply. We need to look not just at what happens in the lab, but what are the greater implications? This is about an entire picture. What are the impacts on a global economy? Who controls it? What are the impacts on global ecosystems? This is incredibly complex, what we're looking at, and we don't fully understand it.
So, Dana, I want to get back to both the environmental and health questions involved here, but I want to invite listeners to be part of this conversation at 866-798-TALK. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is your call. We are talking about biosynthetic technology, and really, this is really emerging very quickly right here in Northern California as one of the centers of research and applications of this technology. So if you want to know more, if you have questions, this is a great time to ask them. And maybe you're someone who's actually actively involved in this research. We know there are thousands of people here in the Bay Area working on this stuff. Or you're someone who has real concerns about where this technology is headed and how it might be used. You can give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You're also welcome to email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And actually, I want to just talk about this specific question, and I want to turn it back to Jack. The question of, so you have something like this anti-malarial drug, or for instance, you have something like vanilla, which right now is grown in certain parts of the world, largely by kind of peasant producers of this stuff. And here, you know, folks are in the first world creating something that will replace, not only provide that cheaply enough, it's going to replace these folks' livelihood. When you do this work, do you think about those kind of implications?
Yeah, I think, well, certainly with the artemisinin project, what was first and foremost on our mind was, and when we started this in 2004, 2005, was the tremendous shortage that existed at that time of artemisinin. And, you know, roughly, I don't know, close to 800,000, mostly kids that were dying for lack of the cure. And that was sort of top of our mind. Now, there were other solutions that were brought to bear. And A2S2, the Artemisinin Association, I have to applaud their work in really trying to corral farmers to plant this low-value crop, you know, when other crops might even be more attractive financially to those farmers, because basically they have a plot of land and they want to plant whatever, you know, is most valuable. Now, the part of this that was really heartbreaking is when the shortage was occurring, you know, in 2005, 2006, the extractors, those folks that would buy the botanical leaves and then, you know, extract and warehouse those, you know, of course, when you're speculating on any commodity, you know, it's just sort of the business principle, you know, if the price is going up, you hold it. So while there was, you know, shortages at that time, you know, and there was plenty of material in warehouses, people would just hold that until the price topped out. And I think what this alternative source of artemisinin allowed was, you know, a relief of that sort of agricultural monopoly. Now we have two sources of artemisinin. And this year, you know, prices are at record lows. And, you know, so I have nothing bad to say about the agricultural sources and the, you know, the other ways that we can achieve a result, all in favor of those. But I think technology is part of that solution.
And, Dan, I just want to bring you back in. I mean, you at Friends of the Earth are involved in a campaign specifically focused on the synthetic vanillin that's expected to hit the market this next year. Talk about what your key objections to that are.
Sure. I think similarly to what was just brought up, first of all, the price of a product and having that price drop and becoming cheaper is not actually a benefit for the thousands, hundreds of thousands of small farmers across the world who are dependent on growing this crop, whose entire livelihoods and national economies depend on this crop. And I think that part of the thing that we see both with vanilla as well as artemisinin is that a shifted demand to vanillin or artemisinin grown in petri dishes in labs is not a complement. It doesn't share the stage with the botanical source. In fact, it replaces the demand. And I would also just say that there was that this isn't a secret that the botanical demand will be replaced. In fact, it's been quoted by Jay Keesling that moves are afoot to replace the entire world supply. And early on, that might have not been the goal to replace this agricultural form, but now it's inevitable that this will shift over. And so what you see with vanilla is you see hundreds of thousands of farmers across the global south whose culture and livelihoods and ways of life are centered around a very high-valued crop, which is grown quite sustainably, and it has a very the way that a vanilla is grown is highly dependent on an intact rainforested area. And if you remove the demand of that crop within the rainforest, it also means that you're going to have to replace those rainforests with other crops, such as sugarcane. So the biggest thing is there isn't a need for these new products. Two, it absolutely has an enormous impact on entire populations. We want to talk about solving health problems. One of the root causes of health problems is poverty. And if you sink an entire region of the world into poverty, that's not going to help their health problems. And it's also, you can't assume that there's going to be alternative livelihoods for people. Nature doesn't work that way.
All right, well, Dana, we've got folks starting to call in, and plus there's a lot of different issues to cover about this, so I want to make sure we have time to address them. Specifically, when you're talking about health effects of this, I think a lot of people, when they hear, oh, hey, ice cream this next year that I might buy might have synthesized vanillin in it. I mean, first, I just want to hear, Jack, if you could explain, how would that work? What does it mean to synthesize vanilla? And how is that different? People know about artificial vanilla. How is what's being developed different from that?
Well, I would say that, from a molecular point of view, vanillin is a single molecule that is produced by vanilla bean and can also be produced from, basically petrochemical feedstocks in the form of artificial vanillin, a single molecule. And it's not something that Amaris does, so I'm no expert here, but I did look a little bit at this. And so artificial vanillin and biosynthetically produced vanillin at the molecular level should be fairly identical. Now, extracted vanilla out of the vanilla bean actually has thousands of different molecules in it. It's extracted, I think, with bourbon. Of course, that has a bit of a different flavor oftentimes, but it's thousands of molecules that contribute to that. So what I suspect is that, the single molecule from a scientific standpoint will sort of look a fair amount, if not identically, to the synthesized version.
But in terms of how it's actually made, explain the process. I think a lot of folks just don't know. How does this work?
Ah, yes. Sure. So I would imagine that, again, within the vanilla bean, there is the, genetic code for how to make the vanillin molecule. And you can take that out of the vanilla bean, and you could put it in a yeast or some microbe that's currently used in fermentation. And now that microbe will do what the vanilla plant did, and that is make this molecule vanillin. You'll feed that microbe, again, whatever it normally eats. Usually it's some form of sugar or starch, or people are working on cellulosic feedstocks, but whatever a microbe would ferment traditionally into an alcohol that we would drink as a beer or wine, it now has the genetic instructions for making this more complex molecule.
And so yes, jump in there.
I would just step in for a second and emphasize that these are computerized engineered yeast cells. And this is a big difference that I think a lot of people don't understand, is that we are creating new organisms that do not exist anywhere in nature, that we can at this point type into a computer the DNA code that we wish to see and create entirely new metabolic pathways. So while a yeast might normally produce beer and we feed it with sugar, we can now create these cells to pump out whatever we code them with, whether it's vanillin or saffron. And this is an entirely new organism that does not exist anywhere in nature, and it's incredibly complex, but we don't know the implications specifically with vanillin. This has been fairly untested.
So I want to bring
point, it's entirely unregulated.
On that question of regulation, I actually want to bring, we're going to be going to a break in just a moment, but Eleanor Pauls, you've been very patiently waiting to join this conversation, and you are a public policy scholar with the Woodrow Wilson International Center, and you focus on regulation around biosynthetics and biotechnology more broadly. So something like this, we have vanillin that is synthetically created. This will be going on the market. What kind of regulatory framework is there both for the production of this and how it might be used as a product?
Sure. So, you know, we are not operating in a vacuum here. We have a systems and regulation in place that have been used for past technologies for decades now. And so the key question is, how do we make sure these systems and regulation are adequate for the new capacities of synthetic biology? So the view that the U.S. is taking is actually that, in this case, you look at the product. So you consider that the product is going to be the same as the one you would have harvested in nature. So in that case, you don't really change the way you should look at risk assessment. So we're going to apply the same coordinated biotech framework that we've been using in the past. It's a fairly solid system that we have actually in place for the first generation of product coming from synthetic biology. So the question, the complex question are going to come when you are going to go further into engineering the microbes. And one of the key questions is actually the release of synthetic microbes into the environment. I mean, that's something that's extremely difficult to understand in terms of implication at this stage. So some critics are saying that, you know, once in the environment, it would be pretty impossible to recall or clean up the organism, and they could become a new class of invasive species. What do I think about this? I don't know yet. You know, we don't have done enough studies to actually know what the implications could be. So our perspective at the Wilson Center, what we do in our everyday studying, we got support from the National Science Foundation and from several private foundations to organize group of researchers that come from different disciplines. And that's something you don't see happening most of the time. So, you know, synthetic biologists work in their lab on their science, and it doesn't happen often that they actually talk to ecologists or soil microbiologists or all those other kinds of knowledge we need to bring in into the debate. So we've been doing that for a few years now. We get these people to be in the same room for a few days and to talk to each other. So what do? They actually share models, they share data, they share information, and they work together on unknowns. You know, they come up with a list of unknowns we don't know, and those unknowns are then translated to federal agencies.
Well, Eleanor, I'm going to stop you right there. There are a lot of unknowns in this conversation we want to bring forward in the rest of the hour, including folks calling on the phone, joining the conversation here at Your Call. I'm Matt Martin. Our subject today is biosynthetic technology, its promises, its risks, what you want to know. We'll be back with your questions after this break.
Your Call here on Local Public Radio. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a perspective that has not yet been voiced in today's discussion or a question you'd like to have answered. Please give us a call. 866-798-TALK. 866-798-8255. You can email your question or comment if you prefer to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the World Service of the BBC, World Have Your Say. Following that at noon, it's Bina, and then this afternoon, Open Air with David LaTulipe.
For those of you joining us right now, I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. On tomorrow's show, it's going to be our weekly media roundtable where we talk with journalists about coverage of the week's big news. And today, we're talking about the value of biosynthetics, the risks and benefits of this emerging technology. Joining us for this hour are Jack Newman. He's the chief science officer and co-founder of Amyris Incorporated, a renewable fuels and chemicals company in Emeryville here in the Bay Area. Also from Washington, Eleanor Powles, who's a public policy scholar with the Science and Technology Innovation Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center, and also Dana Pearls, food and technology campaigner with Friends of the Earth. I invite you to call us and join this conversation at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Whether you're someone who's just getting up to speed on biosynthetic technology or you are part of what a lot of people are saying will be a bioindustrial revolution, we want to hear from you, hear your questions, comments, and how you look to the future of this particular technology. And we actually have a call from someone who's involved in this kind of work. Kaushal, welcome to the program.
Hi, my name is Kaushal, and I used to work for a biofuels company in the Bay Area, and now I work in the agricultural sphere out of the Fresno Central Valley area. So I've seen both sides of the spectrum, and I personally really like synthetic biology, and I think it has a lot of promise. I've seen how safe most of these labs are, and like when people talk about GMO, like most of the cancer drugs that we have in the market right now come through GMO products, and nobody has a problem using them. But when it comes to food, people have a lot more reservations. It's understandable. So when people use the argument point about how agricultural farmers are going to be impacted if you bring in synthetic biology, I would like to point out that with my experience in agriculture, most of the small farmers actually don't sell their vanilla or malaria drugs on the open market. They give it to second-party processors or consolidators who actually take most of the risk and actually set the prices. So overall, if you do have two different markets, one is plant-extracted vanilla beans, vanilla flavors compared to synthetically modified ones, I think the market will still exist. And it should not, I think having such new technology coming in just keeps the price more honest overall for the end consumer, who might actually not care what the final product is. So I'll take the comments off of here.
Thanks so much, Kaushal. Dana, you want to respond to what Kaushal had to say there? Dana Pearls, are you with us?
Yes. I think it was a little hard to hear.
Well, I think I can try to restate some of what Kaushal had to say, which I think is particularly saying, actually, the most of the people actually producing something like vanilla are not selling it on the open market. They're going through middlemen who then are the people who actually set the price. And that what this does is actually forces those middlemen to be more competitive and have a more honest pricing system. It may not actually roll back to where people are not going to be able to maintain their livelihood.
And I would say that while I wish that were the case, I think that's unfortunately not the case. What you have is, if in fact you have a product that is much cheaper than what those middlemen can sell it for, it's going to just create a demand for the synthetic product and remove the demand for the botanical product. And I think that that is what we've already started to see with different artificial products as well, that this synthetic biology ingredients, especially when it comes to vanilla, is not to complement it. It's not to provide extra supply. This is an attempt to replace it. And also, I think, again, we really need to look at what the impacts are, not just of the product itself, not just the impacts on the company, but that it's also shifting the burden of nature. So what is the impact on the sugarcane industry? Do we have the land necessary to scale up to support both the botanical supply as well as this synthetic supply to feed all of those yeast cells and to scale up at an industrial level? We need an enormous amount of feedstock, and that's sugarcane, which is not sustainable.
Yeah, so I want to turn this to Jack Newman, just because, Jack, I know that not too long ago your company actually made an agreement with a Brazilian airline to provide jet fuel. Is that my understanding? That comes from this kind of process. And I guess my question when I heard that, because I understand that one of the arguments in favor of biosynthetics is that they'll let us replace some petrochemical products with these biosynthetically created products. But I was thinking, I'm like, okay, well, if this comes from whether it's corn or cane sugar, wherever that energy source for the yeast or whatever you're growing this fuel in comes from, aren't we essentially flying jet planes with topsoil? I mean, is that really an ecologically sound approach?
Well, and, you know, I don't want to confound the issue of agricultural policy and synbio policy, because I think there certainly is a lot of room for global improvement in agricultural policy. Mm-hmm. I think everybody would agree with that. One of the reasons why we chose Brazil and sugarcane as a feedstock was because of its incredibly good environmental record and low carbon footprint. And I'll tell you just sort of very roughly without, you know, getting too much into the details, you know, how you can understand that. So Brazil in the 70s during the first energy crisis said, you know, and just had horrific effects on the Brazilian economy, said we never want to be held hostage to petroleum again. And they made huge investments in sugarcane to produce ethanol. And they also mandated flex fuel cars so that people would have the choice of either using ethanol or petroleum, depending on the price. And that was incredibly successful. And they have mechanized farm equipment now for sugarcane. It's a no irrigation and no fertilizer input. It's a grass, so you mow it and it comes back up, so you don't have to till. It's amazing, and all of this contributes both to its low cost and also its excellent carbon footprint. So if you use, you know, Brazilian sugarcane for biofuel production, you can realize, you know, roughly an 80% reduction in carbon footprint. And that has not only transformed the Brazilian economy, but also gave us a paradigm for how we can do responsible agriculture to allow, you know, the production of these petroleum-like products.
I just want to jump in for a second and caution that actually I think that the sugar cane industry has been shown to be one of the more horrible industries for not only the impacts on deforestation across the global south, but also as one of the leading industries with problems of slave labor and having quite detrimental environmental impact. So I just want to, I would like to caution that statement right there.
Jack, go ahead, finish your thought.
Well, I'm not sure, you know, where that comes from. I will say that, you know, I'm happy to have this debate. And, you know, we've had Eric Hoffman at Amaris from Friends of the Earth. You know, I'd actually love to go down to Brazil with some folks from Friends of the Earth, because I think what you'll find is that modern Brazilian sugarcane is just not the case. In the first place, one of the misconceptions is that, you know, sugarcane competes with rainforest, and in fact, they couldn't be further apart geographically. And the other is that now the sugarcane industry, you know, it looks a lot like wheat in the U.S. You know, we're not talking about hand-harvested, you know, sort of turn-of-the-century agriculture, which, you know, has had, a bad reputation for good reason, you know, because that's what it was. But these are, you know, combine-like, you know, very modern agriculture using satellite technology to ensure that you are efficiently harvesting sugar cane with these mechanized systems. It really looks a lot different today, but maybe it just requires an update sort of in terms of the agricultural.
Well, Jack, I just want to ask one follow-up question before we go to callers. We've got a lot of folks who want to talk here. But if fundamentally this, I mean, the input for this industry comes from agricultural products, modern agriculture, a lot of it kind of monoculture, but also it's like we're talking about lots of industrial products drawing on one of our most precious resources, which is topsoil. Do we want to make that the basis for our next level of industrial engineering?
Yeah, so I think that if you look at the land that's being used for sugarcane now, which is mostly reclaimed pasture land in Brazil, we've probably got a tenfold excess to expand into. By then, what we'll have to do is really focus on some of the advanced feedstocks that the U.S. is investing in. I think the whole globe is investing in cellulosic feedstocks. And for those, you know, listeners who might not be familiar with this, This is the idea that we can break down sort of the agricultural waste products, the cellulose, to liberate the sugars that are within those polymers, those cellulose polymers, and that would probably free up another tenfold. All that on top of, you know, basically increasing agricultural productivity, which I think is also part of the whole revolution in being able to produce more material from less land.
That's Jack Newman. He is the Chief Science Officer at Amyris. Also with us is Eleanor Polish. She's with the Woodrow Wilson Institute, and also Dana Pearls, who's with Friends of the Earth. And I want to welcome onto the program Catherine in San Francisco, who's called in to your call. Welcome, Catherine.
Hey. I had two questions or comments. One has to do with the fact that we can't patent nature and thus can't profit off of these botanicals. So it's necessary to extract these single molecules, but unfortunately, they, for the most part, create allergies, hormone disruptors, etc., in humans. So that doesn't seem like a great idea. The other comment or question I have has to do with the fact that pretty much all of these botanicals were discovered by indigenous peoples of the earth. And I'm wondering, these companies that are in biosynthetics that are profiting, I'm wondering what kind of compensation is being made to the indigenous peoples in their countries.
Eleanor, thank you so much, Catherine, for the call. Eleanor Powles, can you talk about that, the kind of status of patents around this kind of thing and ownership? And is there any attempt to make sure that that there is some kind of return that goes back to the people who might have, you know, done the original engineering of this stuff at a very local level?
Sure. This is a really complex issue that's actually on the agenda of the UN and the State Department right now. So as you learned in last June, the Supreme Court said that we can actually not patent isolated DNA, right, from the human system, but that's probably
from the human system.
Yeah, but also from that's probably going to be extended to some of the microbial libraries. So isolated DNA cannot be patented, but if you modify it to some extent, so if you produce a form of synthetic DNA or complementary DNA, so a form that's actually different from what you find in nature, then you can actually get ownership out of it and use patents. So, you know, the Supreme Court gave a really balanced judgment in that sense, because they let some possibilities for the industry to actually, you know, produce innovation and get some benefit out of it. Now, the question of how do we balance equity and how do we actually give reward to some of the countries that are actually the owners of those natural resources and those specific microbes that we want to examine, study, and use in the future, that's a really difficult question that has not been settled down yet. But for the first time in May 2014 at the UN meeting on the Nagoya Protocol, this question is going to be raised. So it's actually a good time for scientists and for NGOs and for people who care about this issue to actually carry out some of their arguments and try to think, you know, upstream in advance, how can we design ways of rewarding some of those populations, and how do we need to think about ownership? Do we want to have maybe an open source system, a system that's much more open and that creates some sharing of information and create innovation? Those are questions that actually need to be settled down in the future.
Yeah, actually, so Jack Newman, did the Supreme Court decision that happened recently, and that then, I almost seem to think is going to have broader implications, is that going to affect your ownership of the technologies you're developing?
Well, I'm not actually a patent lawyer, so I don't know that
sure.
I could actually.
You must think about these things.
But I do think about these things, and in fact, I serve on the board of the BioBricks Foundation, and the mission there is to, quote, ensure the engineering of biology is done in an open and ethical manner to benefit the people of the planet. And, you know, I thought that decision was a great decision. Patents have their utility, in my own personal view, in that they reward the innovation of the inventor. But oftentimes patents sort of get tangled in just questions of ownership and exclusion, and that's not really what they were designed for. I think that the industry will benefit from a much more open system of patenting or copyright that looks a lot more like software than it does like biotechnology. And that's my own personal opinion, that not only will it be better for, you know, everyone on the planet, but actually it will stimulate more scientific discovery both within industry and academia.
And Dana Perls at Friends of the Earth, when it comes to these ownership questions, what's your perspective?
I think that it's a really important question that has a lot of problems. When we place a few resources or a large amount of resources in the hands of a few companies, it doesn't equate equity. It doesn't lead to a place where products are accessible and open. And when you remove a plant that right now is accessible to hundreds of thousands of people across the world, and you put it in the hands of a couple of corporations, and you remove the demand for that plant, that does not lead to respect. That is not a respect for indigenous cultures. That is certainly not leading to an equitable system across the planet, and certainly isn't ethical when a company is able to coercively remove the livelihoods of hundreds of thousands of farmers. I really think that when we talk about regulations, we're talking about regulations of a specific product, but we need to look at the entire impact that this can have on the entire world, the moral implications, the shifting of the burden, as you said, the destruction of topsoil, deforestation, and the removal of livelihoods.
So, Dana, Friends of the Earth, I know you specifically are campaigning against this synthetic vanillin that we think is going to come on the market this next year.
Correct.
So when it comes to talking about regulation, right now, as things stand, is Friends of the Earth, or are you, as you speaking for yourself, willing to say, you know, here is some way we could have, here's a framework for how this research could go forward and maybe some of these products could come forward? I mean, is there anything you would say we could actually go forward with now, or do you basically think there needs to be a halt to this until we know more, look at the implications?
I think that this product, the synthetic biology vanillin, is not ready to come onto the market because we don't understand the implications. Not only do we not understand the implications on our environment, we also don't understand the implications on human health, and we haven't yet figured out a way so that this invention, which is not needed, it's unnecessary right now, and it is for the profit of a few large corporations, how is that not going to have a global impact that is more harmful than helpful? And who is this going to benefit? It's not going to benefit the consumer. It's not going to benefit the vanilla farmers. And it's certainly not going to benefit the people who will be displaced from the land.
Right. Okay, so we've gone through that discussion. What I want to know is there some kind of biosynthetic technology that you'd say at this time, okay, that's fine to develop that, provided that we have some kind of regulatory framework?
If there were a regulatory framework that included independent third-party, independent scientific testing, that had assessment, that had all the questions that have been unanswered answered, then anything is possible. There's a lot of potential if we understand what we're doing, in the same way that when DDT came out, the thought was that this is going to be really great, it's very new, it has a lot of potential, and now we're still feeling the repercussions. We need to move with precaution. And so it's not that this entire process is impossible to do responsibly, but we're not there yet. We certainly haven't figured out how to do it yet. Until we have, we should not move forward.
That's Dana Perls. I'll bring you right in, Eleanor, in just a moment. That's Dana Perls, Food and Technology Campaign of Friends of the Earth. Also just jumping in there was Eleanor Powles, who's a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center. And also with us is Jack Newman, who's Chief Science Officer for Amyris Incorporated, which is a renewable fuels and chemicals company in Emeryville, California. And we invite your calls and questions about biosynthetic technology, where it's headed, how it might be regulated, who it benefits. Your calls at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 866-798-2558, 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And actually, I want to read an email that came in from a listener named Stuart, who says, the development and deployment of these products is being handled by an industry with the moral, ethical, and historical perspective of a teenage boy. It's also, gee whiz, we ought to be saying, that's nice, kid, but go back to your lab and invent something we really need. So I want to. So this, obviously, I think he's talking to you, Jack. So how would you respond?
Well, flattery. If a 47-year-old, you know, still be considered a kid, and I think there is a lot of optimism, and I'm glad that comes through. You know, I certainly think artemisinin was quite a useful project, and I think that, you know, something we are absolutely going to have to figure out sometime in the next 50 years is how we get off petroleum. Because let's face it, there is only so much, and if we ran out tomorrow, that would be a disaster. And so, you know, pushing forward in this direction, you know, through these different products all facilitates a different feedstock for us to base our economies on, and one that is fundamentally renewable from biology. So I'm very optimistic and excited about that. But I do want to point out that, you know, this has been going on since 1975. And many, many products have been replaced by recombinant DNA technology. So I'll give you for example. Cheese is made through rennet, which is often extracted from the stomachs of animals. It's what causes the cheese to curdle, or the milk to curdle to cheese. You can make rennet the same way through an enzymatic process where that enzyme that used to come from an animal's stomach is now made in a fermentation. And 70% of the cheese that's out there is made with that kind of rennet, which is, by the way, also vegetarian. And, you know, it's not that we haven't been creating useful things. It's that, you know, now what's over $1 billion of industry or products or things that people use has, you know, reached some sort of utility without us really noticing, because it basically replaces things in a more effective way that we've been using.
So Jack, I mean, obviously your focus is on, hey, here's what we can create, here's what it can do. You know, we've got, Dana brings some really serious concerns, and I think one that we didn't get to talk as much about that Eleanor brought up is this, if some of these synthesized organisms were to get into the environment, what the effects might be. Do you think in terms of regulation, everything is hunky-dory, or there needs to be, or to have that really responsible kind of future to this industry, there needs to be more regulation than there is now?
Well, I think that in 75, actually, when we first sort of outlined this technology, there was a moratorium and a shutdown. And, you know, the leading minds of the science came together and came up with guidelines which are now employed in the basis of a lot of the regulation that's out there. And I think since then we've had, you know, 40 years of a impeccable safety record.
So your basic position is we've got a good framework. It's been going for 40 years. Let's keep that in place. Eleanor, you've looked a lot at this stuff. What do you think may not be being dealt with in this current framework?
Well, it's mainly, you know, what would come from the next generation of the product coming from synthetic biology. So the most you're going to engineer the genome, the less you're going to know about, you know, how it's going to react and how it's going to evolve and how stable it's going to be in different kind of environments. So those are, you know, long-term implications, maybe in 10 years, 20 years, we have to look at. But I wanted to tackle some of the points raised by Dana and Jack, and, you know, we work on a daily basis with experts in federal agencies here, and those people are really looking at these complex issues from close in their everyday work. So it's not like they are operating without knowledge. They are following all the studies that are getting out. They are actually working on technology assessment methods. They are talking to scientists, and we've been doing that for a few years now, as I was explaining. We try to get those people from different kind of knowledge in the same room, so that they can work on models, they can work on predictions to try to see, you know, what are the unknowns and where we need to work further on regulation. So maybe, you know, you also see that developing on the East Coast and on the West Coast, actually, those places are called bio-incubators. And you have entrepreneurs, scientists, computer scientists, policy wonks, all those people are together in a room and they try to figure out what the implications could be. So we might need to think about, you know, another culture of looking, of anticipating implications, technological implications. Maybe we need to get different kind of people in the room so that they can actually work together on complex issues. Now, I wanted to give you a little more of a big picture, too. You know, we talked about vanilla a lot. Well, synthetic biology is much more than that. It's a revolution in making. So it's producing things with greater precision, atom by atom and gene by gene. It's also a conceptual revolution.
Eleanor, I hate to interrupt you because we are coming towards the end of the program. And what I really want to direct everybody who's listening to do, because we really just started both on the risks about this and, like you're saying, a sense of what the potential of this technology is. And I really want to direct everybody who is interested in this question, whose interest has been piqued, to go to our website, yourcallradio.org, where you will see both information from Friends of the Earth, as well as from Amaris and the Wilson Center, where Eleanor Powles is, that gives you a lot more information about this. We've got 60 seconds left. I'd like to get 30 seconds quickly from Dana and from Jack before we go, and I apologize once again for having to cut you off, Eleanor. What would you like to end with, Dana? What's your last thought?
I just want to point out that it's really important that we think about the entire picture, that we don't just focus on the individual products, but what happens when we scale this up. As Eleanor said, this is not just about vanilla. This is not just about artemisinin. This is about an entirely new technological revolution. And that before we dive into something, it's important to look at the complexities, look at the implications, and learn from our lessons from the past. When we dive into something too quickly, we feel the impacts and the detriments years
Dana,
later.
We're going to have to leave that there. And I want to thank all three of you for being part of this conversation. That was Dana Pearl. She is a food and technology campaigner with Friends of the Earth. Jack Newman, Chief Science Officer at Amaris. Thank you for being with us, Jack. And also Eleanor Powles with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss a federal judge's ruling that the NSA's data mining of U.S. citizens' phone records is unconstitutional. We'll also talk about the row between India and the U.S. over the arrest of an Indian diplomat in New York City. We'll be joined by The Guardian's Dan Roberts, First Post's Sandeep Roy, and Trevor Tim of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.